Thank you. Yeah, so it's a great pleasure to come here again. And I would like to thank the organizers to give me this opportunity to present some work. So today I will talk about symmetric tensor networks and topological spaces. I think this title somehow perfectly match this workshop. Yeah, so I'm from Boston College. Firstly, let me thank my collaborators. So Shenghan Jiang is my student, who is graduating soon. And we also have collaboration with SKKU, Professor Jin Hong Han's group. And there are also some people in the audience from Station Q. So these are the references. So the work that I will present is mainly driven by Shenghan, who does both pretty challenging analytical study and numerical studies. So let me start from a motivation. So this talk, we will focus on some bosonic topological spaces, just for simplicity. And if you think about the bosonic topological spaces, we know it certainly requires strong interactions to realize. So there are many outstanding issues about these topological spaces. So roughly speaking, there are some conceptual issues more related to, say, for example, classification problems and the symmetry anomaly, and so on. And there are also, I would say, maybe a little bit more practical issues. So in fact, my motivation is probably mainly from the practical side. So the question is, how do we realize these bosonic topological spaces? And theoretically, we know there are a lot of them. But they may be realized in some quite artificial exasol-solver models. But we should pay attention to some more realistic models, maybe hopefully realizable in experiments. But now we realize these seem to be quite challenging to find these realizations. So I would say maybe the challenge comes from two sides. The first maybe challenge is we probably still need more physical intuitions or some guiding principles to think about the realizations. So for example, we know topological insulators are, it's like a milestone in this field of topological spaces. And the reason why it got realized, okay, of course, there are many reasons, but from my point of view, there are at least one important reason, which is the inventors of these topological insulators give a very clear physical intuition. So it talks like Charlie Kane and Liang Fu and Ma Li. So they give us this very simple picture. So it tells us if you just invert the band, you necessarily get into this fermionic topological phase. And that's easy to be realized in materials. So we somehow need this kind of intuitions. So we do something, and then we necessarily get into this topological phases. But now we are having strong interaction, so we don't have band picture. So maybe there's something else can do the similar job. Another challenge is from this, it's just the intrinsic difficulty of this strongly interaction system. So in order to pin down the phase diagram and search for, say, topological phases, we need some numerical methods. In particular, we probably need some more numerical methods suitable for this topological state of matter. So when we talk about numerical methods for quantum phase diagram, quite generically, we probably more or less mean some variational methods. There are these quantum Monte Carlo methods, which works very well, but it's somehow limited to special models, which don't have a sign problem. So for generic models, we probably want to do some variational study. And the question is, can we write down some generic trial wave function? And can practically search for these topological states. So those are the motivations. So let me firstly present the main result. So the main result is a machinery. So we say we based on this tensor network formulation, we develop a machinery. So this machinery is useful in many aspects. So what it can do is it can systematically but partially classify topological phases, and it can be used to construct generic trial wave functions for these phases using tensor network wave function. So the strategy, so the way that this machinery works is the following. So you input the symmetry of your system, and then there's a well-defined procedure to follow and to classify this symmetric tensor networks and also topological phases. And for every phase, almost every phase, I would say, so in fact, for every phase protected by a discrete symmetry, you can construct the generic tensor network wave function. And sometimes for continuous symmetry, you can also do this general construction. And this constructed wave function are like this. So these are the one-dimensional matrix product states and two-dimensional PEPs. So I'm very sure that this was mentioned earlier in this program. So these methods are way to write down wave function is very powerful because it can do very powerful numerics, and also for other reasons. Okay, at least one reason is numerically it's very friendly. So what this machinery really does is the following: it answers the following question. So you imagine you write down such a tensor network wave function. And you require this wave function to be symmetric. And then you ask yourself, can I smoothly deform one tensor network wave function to another tensor network wave function, respecting the symmetry and smoothly? So if two tensor network wave functions cannot be smoothly deformed into each other, respecting symmetry under certain assumption, then they belong to different classes. So this is really a classification of this symmetric tensor network wave function up to smooth deformation. So in some sense, you can probably visualize this classification is really about the topology, because it's a classification of objects up to smooth deformation. Here, the object is the symmetric tensor network.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah.
So you mean not only to smoothly deform the tensor network, but also to have the parent that would not have a closing gap, right?
That's right. This is implicitly assumed somewhere. Yeah. So there's this a certain assumption. Yeah. So as I mentioned, this method is really powerful because you can do numerics. So combining with this numerical algorithms, one can really perform practical simulations. Okay. So this is the main result. So what I plan to do is to talk about three applications of this machinery. So you can see that this machinery is used in very different contexts. So the first application is about this competing spin liquid states in the in this famous spin one half Heisenberg model on the Kagame lattice. So I will present our efforts to use symmetric tensor network to understand this quantum phase. So the second application, I will talk about the classification of this, I call it bosonic cohomological SPT. So in this framework, we find this bosonic cohomological SPT are classified by this formula. So this formula is probably familiar with many people in the audience. So it's just this D plus one's cohomology group or symmetry group with coefficient in U1. So this same formula was discovered early on for onside symmetry. So here, symmetry group is a full symmetry group, including everything, not only onset, but say translation, rotation, new reflection, everything, and combination of onset and lattice. So here the main new result is if you have this full symmetry including lattice transformation, you can still use this formula. But there's one thing you need to pay attention, which is the time reversal and the mirror. So all the mirror reflections, generally all these determinant equal minus one spatial transformations should be treated as anti-unitary. So because if you try to use this cohomology, you need to define how the symmetric group act on this U1. So it turned out that all these mirrors should be treated as anti-unitary. And this works for D equal 1, 2, 3. In addition, we not only have this classification, we can construct generic wave function for every class if SG is a discrete, and sometimes if SG is continuous. So that's the second application. So the third application, I will talk about the byproduct of this transfer network formulation. So we find a general connection between somewhat conventional symmetry-enriched topological phases and symmetry-protected topological phases in 2D. So let me give you an example to highlight what I mean. So this connection is quite general, but here is a simple example. So think about a toroidal topological order, but in the presence of an Ising symmetry. So the G is Ising symmetry. So we know when G acting on this toroid code, there's a E particle and an M particle both are bosonic. So let's assume this the E particle have a non-trivial Ising symmetry fermionization, but the M has a trivial fermionization. So that namely the Ising symmetry acting on M square equal plus one. But the square equal plus one by itself can be still plus or minus one. So the claim is if you you start from this SET, the same SET, but you can confine the topological order in two ways. You can condense the Vson or the M particle with Ising even quantum number, then you get the trivial SPT. If you condense the Ising odd M particle, you get the non-trivial SPT. So in some sense, this will share some flavor of this band inversion, I would say. So you're not a tuning band, but you are tuning some boson condensate, and this boson carry different quantum number. Yeah. So
by the way, yeah. You mean trivial SPT or non-trivial SPT? Is that the same thing as even Ising gauge theory and all the Ising gauge theory? So this rhetorical code there. There are two kinds of Z2 spin gauge. One is even, another is odd. So is that the same thing as even?
No, so this trivial SPT, so maybe I shouldn't call it SPT. I should call it just a trivial Ising paramagnet. It's just like a product state.
Oh,
yeah.
That's
so this is the non-trivial state with a gapless edge state. Yeah, so. Yeah.
So trivial means it's just trivial, everything is trivial.
It's like a product state. Oh. Yeah. So let me maybe spend 1 minute on this tensor network formulation. I think people must have seen it before. So in this construction, the goal is to construct some physical wave function. So the physical wave function is written like some superposition of some, say, spin configuration in the real space. And what you do is you replace every site in the real space, for example, on a square lattice. You have some spin on every site, but you replace every site by a tensor. And then what you do is you introduce some virtual degree freedom on these virtual legs. And this I leg is the physical leg. So spin live here. But those are the virtual degree freedom. And you contract all the virtual degree freedom. So at the end of the day, you get a physical state. So what I want to highlight here is maybe a more physical point of view to think about this tensor construction is to think about like a local quantum state. So this tensor means you have a lot of complex numbers. But what I try to say is, instead of thinking about it as a tensor, including many complex numbers, it's maybe better to think about it as a single quantum state, but in an enlarged Hilbert space. You really think about these virtual legs are some virtual Hilbert space. So this way of thinking, I think, is more somehow more physical. Yeah. So then the question is why we want to pay attention to this tensor network formulation. So historically, it's turned out that I think that maybe the first deep insight in this, say for example, SPT phases, was obtained using this formulation, but in one dimension. And of course, we also have some practical motivation because we really want to do numerics. So we know this in 1 and 2D, the tensor networks are associated with pretty developed numerical methods. But in particular, what I the true reason why we want to pay attention to the tensor networks to study topological phases and construct wave functions is the following. So the tensor network is really like a Lego game. So you can construct a very big wave function, physical wave function, by putting together small pieces. Every piece is like a local tensor. So this formulation allows you to conveniently look at a local piece of a very big wave function, and that's useful. Because it turned out that to understand a lot of topological phases, it's crucial to understand how the symmetry act on the global wave function, but in the local patch. So for example, symmetry formalization, all those concepts are related to this local symmetry action. So in this tensor language, if I know how every single local tensor transform under symmetry, then I put them together, I know how the global wave function transforms the symmetry. And also, if I cut a piece, I know how that piece transforms under symmetry. So that's the main advantage. So let me try to follow this plan and see how far I can go. So I will firstly discuss this spin liquid embodiment of this. So this is a quite famous model. It's a very simple looking. It's just a Heisenberg model on this so-called Kagome lattice. On every side, if there's a spin 1/2, J is positive for anti-ferromagnetic interaction. So the question is, what's a quantum phase? What's the ground state of this Hamiltonian? This naive-looking problem turned out to be very difficult. Although I should mention, the symmetry of this model are described by lattice symmetries and, say, on-site spin rotations and time reversal. This naive-looking model has a long history. So in the past, maybe 20, 30 years, there's a whole series of work. And I think it's fair to say, maybe even at this moment, there's no general consensus about the answer for this question. I think you can see the generation is evolving. And actually, recently, there are very cool work by Yin-Chen, Mike, and Frank, and other collaborators. So on the same issue. So it turned out that the DMRG numerical simulation point out the evidence of a spin liquid ground state of this simple model. And for example, people, at least in the past few years, people are thinking that maybe the ground state is a symmetry-induced topological phases protected by both on-site and the lattice symmetry. But we know there are many, many spin liquid like that. The question is which one of them is realized. So that's sort of the question we want to answer. And to answer this kind of question, you certainly want to do numerics. So let me firstly summarize some results. So you can follow that machinery, which allow you to construct a very generic trail wave functions for the tensor network states. So in particular, if you classify those symmetric tensor network wave functions describing Z2 spin liquids, which seem to be the most likely candidate spin liquids on this system, at least one likely candidate spin liquids, one type of likely candidate spin liquids. So you find there are 32 of them. So this 32 is coming from this classification of this symmetric PEPs. So the 32 means there are 5 Z2 indices. So different Z2 indices will give you different type of Z2 spin liquids. And for every single one of this class, we can construct generic trial wave function and perform numerics. So among these 5 Z2 indices, there are these 3 eta indices, which are maybe more familiar. So these are related to this symmetric transition pattern of this spin-on quasi-particle. And so this is consistent with earlier Schrödinger boson results by Fa Wang and Ashwin Vishwanath. And there are some other indices which are new. So these are somewhat related to this weak SPD indices. So for, as I mentioned, for every class, what you do is you implement symmetry in certain rule, under certain rule. And a different class satisfy like a topologically different symmetry transformation rules. And for every class, this transformation rule will constrain the local Hilbert space of this local tensor. And then within this local constraint, the sub-Hilbert space, you can construct a generic wave function. So for example, think about a single side tensor on this lattice. So we are pay attention, for example, we can talk about the bound dimension, virtual bound dimension equals 6. So namely, on the virtual bound, you have a, we are thinking about the spin singlet together with a spin dub, like a spin 1/2 and a spin 1. So totally the dimension is 6. So if you don't implement any symmetry, so this local tensor has a, can be viewed as a state in some enlarged Hilbert space. And that Hilbert space has a dimension which is around 3600. So those are the number of variational parameters you have per site in this using this tensor, if you view this tensor network wave function as a trial wave function or a variational wave function. But it turned out that after you implement symmetry, I was mentioning there are 32 classes, but for this bound dimension, it turned out we can only realize 4 of them. To realize the other classes, we need to have an even bigger B. For these 4 of them, it turned out that symmetry strongly constrains this sub-Hilbert space. So the tensor can only live in a 19-dimensional Hilbert space. You have a much less number of variational parameters, which probably means you can you know, do variational study maybe easily in some sense. Right. So
this is constrained by what? By which symmetries?
By the symmetry, by all the symmetry, by the all the by all these symmetries. Yeah. So it's like this. So if I don't implement this symmetry, any symmetry, so every tensor can be anything, right? But if I want this physical wave function to be symmetric, the tensor cannot be arbitrary. So there have to be some constraint. So eventually what constraint is the limit of the dimension of this local Hilbert space. And yeah.
When you say 32 classes, you mean, suppose I forget about symmetric PEPs. I don't want to use PEPs. I just asked a question, how many is it just the kids on?
Right.
Government lattice?
Yeah, there are more. I think there are more.
Is that answer answerable using current? I mean, suppose I prescription how to calculate how many Z2 spin liquids in Ptolemy without having to go through some specific way of writing them.
Oh. So,
like for example, for as you mentioned, for if I.
Yeah, I think there are results. I think there's a paper by at least Qi Yang and maybe other people. Maybe also Yuan Ming. So there's some way to. At least for gap, the Z2 spin liquids. So it seemed to be true that only these 8 symmetry transition patterns are realizable. Is that right? So I think that's.
Symmetry fragmentation only give you 8. The other 2 are like SPT. Yeah. But I suppose the other 2 index give you some edge mode. Play.
Yeah, so sometimes, yes.
So that can roll out some results, because numerics, you already know whether you have
it or not. Yeah, so So anyway, so those four don't have those non-trivial indices anyway. Yeah, so I think, so this is a construction. It's more like within a framework, how many states we can construct. So the framework is quite general, but you can never convince yourself that's complete. So to ensure that this is the most general number of states, you probably have to do something else, like anomaly detection or something. Okay, but maybe I should describe a little bit about how I implement global symmetry into tensor network. So the basic assumption is that the symmetries on the physical wave function can be implemented as a gate transformation on the internal legs, or this virtual degree freedom. So it turned out that the tensor network construction has a lot of gate redundancy. By gate redundancy, what I mean is you can have a different looking tensors, different looking tensor networks, but after they contract, they give exactly the same physical wave function. So here is a simple example. You think about you're contracting two tensors. So it's perfectly fine to make a general like a linear transformation on this internal leg, but also apply the transformation inverse on the other leg. So this transformation generally will change the form of this local tensor A and B, but after they contract, the phase wave function certainly is not changed. So there are a lot of gate redundancy. So if you have an bound number of bounds, you have a huge number of gate redundancies. So the assumption is, of course, I assume the physical wave function is a symmetric. You apply some G is a symmetry. You apply the wave function. You go back to the same wave function up to some U1 phase. So that's the assumption. So then we also assume that in order for this to happen, the physical symmetry transformation can be canceled by some internal gate transformation, it's a WG. So the WG is the gate transformation. So this ensures that the wave function is a symmetric. For every G, there's a WG on this virtual legs. So namely, the tensor will be invariant under this symmetry action together with the WG gate transformation. So G can be anything, can be any transformation. Don't have to be on-site, can be spatial transformations as well. So it turned out that you can classify the different symmetry transformation groups of these local tensors. More precisely, you can find topological invariants of these symmetry transformation rules of these local tensors. And those symmetry transformation rules, topological distinct symmetry transformation rules, happen to be correspond to different topological phases protected by symmetry. So to understand how I find all these transformation rules and classify them, so we need to pay attention to the consistency condition for this WG transformation. So let me give you a very simple example. So you can think about I implement the spin rotation symmetry. So I want to construct spin singularity wave function. So what I want to do is I do a spin rotation on this physical leg, but I want to cancel it by some transformation on the virtual leg. So for example, you can imagine that these virtual legs are formed by some SU2 representations, some spin degree freedom on the virtual leg. So this means I want to make this local tensor to be spin singlet. But then you realize that this virtual leg cannot only have, say, half integer spins. For example, if you have five half integer spins, there's no way to form a spin singlet. Similarly, there's no way to make this virtual leg to have a spin, integer spins only. So what you really have to do is to have both integer and half integer spin on the virtual leg. So here is a simple example where the bound dimension equals 3, but you can consider much bigger virtual Hilbert space with a lot of other spins. But the point is you must have both integer and half integer spins on the virtual legs in order to form a spin singlet. So here let me mention a very important object in this symmetric tensor classification problem, so which we call invariant gauge group. So for example, you can consider this spin singular tensor that I described a moment ago, but I consider a very simple symmetry transformation. Namely, I perform two pi spin rotation on all the legs. For the physical leg, because spin 1/2, if I rotate the 2 pi, I just get overall -1. But on the virtual leg, as I mentioned, you have both integer and half integer spin. So this spin 1/2 spin 2 pi rotation will be some non-trivial matrix. So I call this matrix to be J. So this J transformation is a very special kind of gauge transformation. So first, the J square is identity, it's like a Z2 matrix. So it's a pure gauge transformation. It's a gauge transformation, it only acts on the virtual leg. It don't touch the physical leg. But it leaves all the single tensor invariant up to some overall phase. So this is a very different from the gauge transformation I mentioned earlier. So usually a gauge transformation will change the local tensor. But now even the local tensor is invariant. So that's making it special. So that's why we call it the invariant gauge group. So this is related to Z2 gauge theory. So the fact that you at least require some Z2 IgG in this system, it actually tells you that at least there's it reflects the fact that there's no featureless trivial symmetric phase. You have to have some gauge dynamics. So there's if you follow this definition, a gauge transformation, so the definition of IgG is this. It's a pure gauge transformation, but you leave all the single tensors invariant. So then if you follow this definition, there's always some trivial IgG, which relate to multiplying some U1 phase factors on these virtual legs. So those are always there. But here, this is a matrix IgG, which is different. So let me briefly describe why this is related to the gauge dynamics. So it turned out that this V2 IgG tells you that this tangential wave function will have a Z2 gauge fluctuation. So for example, I can construct this four-fold ground state on the torus. So let's start from a tensor network a wave function by contracting all these tensors that I described on a torus. So what you can do is you can insert a J string across the non-contractible loop of the torus. So because J is some matrix, so generally this will give you a new wave function. But the point is this new wave function doesn't cost you energy because this J doesn't cost you energy because you can move this J around by this invariant gauge transformation. So you can move this string far away. So the locally this energy density will remain the same. So that's the way you can sort of convince yourself this is related to the Z2 gauge dynamics. You can easily construct these four states on the torus. So in this construction, you can also construct excitations. So the identity particle is like a say ground state, so which satisfies the usual IgG transformation laws. But if you try to create a spin-on, so what you do is you make this local tensor to be spin 1/2, and so that give you so the J is like a Z2 gauge transformation. So the sign change tells you that there's a Z2 gauge charge there. You can also create a Vson by creating this by applying this J string. So this dot means this J action, and the fermions of the bound states. So if you are have a deconfined phase, then it's a spin liquid. Otherwise, you have some ordered phase. So the tensor equation. So we have this symmetry condition. So let me consider say translation symmetry. You can translate one tensor to another tensor, but combined with gauge transformation, you come back. So similarly, you can transform along the y direction. So this is a translation along x, this translation along y. So these conditions have to be self-consistent. So for example, this two translation have to commute, but on the tensor level, you realize yourself this two combined, physical combined with gauge transformation, they don't really have to commute. So that their difference can be an element in this IgG group. So chi is a trivial IgG, like a phase multiplication on the legs, but the eta are this non-trivial, can be this non-trivial matrix multiplication. So eta can be either identity or this J matrix. So this is one of this tensor consistency equation. So it turned out that for translation, this chi can always be tuned to identity by redefining this W. But this eta is topological. So it actually labeled a symmetric transition of the spin on E. So eta can either be identity, namely it's a some zero flux spin liquid, or eta is can be J, which means it's a pi flux spin liquid. So it's a, so let me skip this. So basically what it means is when eta is a trivial, the spin down is transforming in the usual way, but when eta is J, what you realize is under the combined, T1 inverse, T2 inverse, after this sequence of transformation, the spin down don't come back to itself, but it pick up an extra minus one. So the carry is a fractional quantum number. So that's just one example, but there's a general way to follow, which is this machinery. So what you do is you start from the symmetry and you identify your IgG, and then you list all the tensor equations, and then you can solve them by fixing gauge, and then you find all the gauge inequivalent transformation laws which describe these tensors, and then there's a different class will constrain the subhilbert space for every class, and give you the generic tensor wave function. So if you combine numerics, you can try to do a numerical simulation to determine the phase diagram. So that's what it looks like. So this is a sort of a general framework. So for this problem, this Kagome problem, if you work out this procedure, you find all these five little indices. So those are the topological invariants of this tensor symmetry transformation rules. And the different transformation rules, they are topologically distinct. So then we perform some numerics. We have been paying attention to this infinite PEPS algorithm. So what this does is it can allow you to find to perform this energy optimization. So we use this so-called simple update method in this EPEPS algorithm to find the optimal states for these four promising Z2 spin liquid classes. And we can measure this energy density and also other things using other algorithms. For example, we particularly use this tensor RG together with version of Monte Carlo to perform measurements. So here I present this result for this bound dimension equal 7 Kagome PEPS. So what you should read in this diagram is there's some D cut. So this D cut is some cutoff bound dimension one have to introduce in this tensor algorithm. So this is something that's not really physical. It's something that this algorithm have to require. So what is really physical is you should pay attention to this energy density of these four different little spin liquids, but when decard goes to infinity, you want to look at these extrapolated values of the energy density. Okay. So then what you'll find is there are these two pi flux little spin liquids, which has a pretty, at least a significantly higher energy density than the other two, but these are two zero flux little spin liquids. They have a nearly degenerate energy density. So for bound dimension equal 7, if you don't use this symmetric algorithm, you have something like 5,000 variational parameters.
Can I ask?
Yeah.
So why is this blue line fit with a parabola? And the other one seems to be fit by a straight line.
Yeah, so that's a very good question. So, I have to say that I don't have a sharp understanding. Yeah. So this is a
suggest that the two lowest one.
So the fitting is given by so we try this just a power law fitting, but tuning the power to have the best fitting. So this is not justified by any sharp argument. It's basically some empirical exercise. Yeah. So I have to apologize for this, but
you need to say every point has an error bar.
The error bar. So for every point, there is error bar in the Monte Carlo, but that error bar is smaller than the dot size. Yeah, but so what you do, so then you won't have to go to the details of algorithm. So for every d cut, you introduce some cutoff bound dimension to measure the energy density. But then you have to increase this to d cut to get the energy density of the true physical states. Yeah. Yeah, so maybe I can explain this later, because maybe I should proceed for a moment. Yeah.
So what are the four classes that you specified over here? You distinguish zero flux from pi flux.
Right.
So presumably that's related to the ether idea.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
What's the other, what is the one, Roman one and Roman?
Yeah, so those are related to rotations, I think. Yeah. Yeah, so the other lattice symmetries.
But do you have an understanding why out of 32 classes you can only get this score?
Yeah, so there's a simple argument. If you think about the shorter and RAB resonant valence bound states on this Kagome lattice, you can only write down 4. And these are exactly that 4.
The reason it's 4 is because what somehow other symmetries act on local linear settings?
No. Maybe I didn't understand this. So this 4 just means there is a 4 different symmetry transition patterns that can be sort of easily realized.
I'm trying to tie this 4 to the 32, the Z25 that you mentioned on the previous slide.
Right. So this is a 4 corresponding to just a 4 of those 38.
Right. Yeah. Do you know which 4? Which combinations of those two variables give you?
Yeah, I can give it to you afterwards. It's well defined, so that's certainly well defined. Yeah, it's just some complicated plus minus. Yeah. So this energy density turned out to be quite similar to this DMRG report, but maybe the point is here we only have something like 40 bidirectional parameters. Compared to solvents, So here we find that these 2-0 flux states are nearly degenerate. So the question is, which class is a ground state? So these 2-0 flux have more popular names given by Sachdev. So this is a Q1 equal Q2 state, and this is Q1 equal minus Q2 states. So somehow we find their energy density are very similar. So there are two possibilities. The first, their energy density are different, but our numerics are not accurate enough to distinguish them. So in fact, we are trying to improve our algorithm, maybe to sharply distinguish these two. But there's another reason, another possibility. So they could, in principle, they could share exactly the same degenerate energy density. And this happens under some physical reason. So it turned out that both these Z2 spin liquids are descendant states of a parent states, which are called some U1 Dirac spin liquids. If you start from this Dirac spin liquid, but you introduce different Higgs mechanism, you can Higgs this U1 down to Z2, but you can get these two different zero flux states. So if the true ground state is indeed this parent state, but we are using this descendant state to simulate, then it's actually reasonable that they share the same energy density because they both can approximate the parent states. Oh. Yeah.
Exactly same? Is there some?
Yeah, so the claim is if it's really a U1 Dirac spinningquit, if you perform this all this bound dimension scaling and you do the correct energy minimization, then this two trial wave function should give you the exact same energy. It's like I can use the descendant. It's like you think about I have a symmetric state, but I use a symmetry breaking state to simulate the problem. But then I can put my symmetry breaking outer parameter to very small, zero. So then they're the same. So it's like that. Yeah. So it's a sort of a, like an interesting way to apply this method, right? So.
But do you feel like correlation length becoming larger as you increase the?
We haven't measured correlation length yet. Yeah. So maybe yeah. So there are a lot of things to be done. So that's what I'm saying here. Yeah. Okay. So maybe so I have 1 hour. Okay, good. So I think I should be fine. So now let me talk about this other topics. So you can see here I demonstrate some practical application of this method. Maybe now I talk about something maybe slightly more conceptual. So let's think about this bosonic cohomological SPT phases. So for example, the Houdin chain is a well-known example. So in our framework, as I mentioned, these are somehow classified, partially classified by this group cohomology. But this SG is a full symmetry group. But you should pay attention, both T and P should be anti-unitary. So let me first give you some example. In 1D, so these are well-known results previously. If you put in Z2 time reversal or Z2P, the Z2 group generated by Miro, as I mathematically, the point is both need to be treated as anti-unitary. So mathematically, these two guys are the same object. So they both give you Z2. So they have one non-trivial SPT in both symmetry groups. In 2D, you can think about a system with both time reversal and the mirror reflection. And again, both should be treated as anti-unitary. And if you compute this, you'll find that there are four different phases.
If you make one of them unitary, does the answer change?
For example, if you make this unitary, this one,
yeah.
It doesn't change. Yeah, if you this one, it doesn't change. Yeah, that's true. You can redefine.
I guess you can just compile.
You can redefine generators. Yeah. So, and we can for this classification, for every class, if you have a discrete symmetry group, for every class. We can construct this kind of a generic trial wave function. It's very similar to this spinliquid example. We can have some constrained subspace and some generic trial wave function. And the byproduct of this construction is a connection between SET and SPT. So let me maybe start from a very simple problem. So this was certainly worked out before. So let's think about D equal 1 case, okay? But then the main purpose here is to demonstrate in this formulation that we are working with, it's very obvious that the mirror reflection should be treated as anti-unitary. So that's the main purpose. So we should firstly identify this IgG and then find the consistent equations for the tensor symmetry transformation rules. So let's think about this one-dimensional tensor. So it's just the matrix product state. So the symmetry condition, as before, we require after symmetry transformation the tensor come back. But now we are thinking about the infinite lattice. So we can require the symmetry transformation to send all the tensor back to itself without any extra U1 phase. So this is somehow mathematically simpler to deal with. So local tensor don't even pick up a phase. So then you can consider similar IgG. So I require this IgG to be gate transformation, leave every single tensor invariant, not even a phase, not even up to phase, completely invariant. So then you'll realize, generically, if you don't have symmetry breaking, the IgG for this metric product state will be given by this very simple phase multiplications. So on every bound, there's a variable, but all these variables are related. It's simply like this. So this is your IgG. So then we know the symmetry transformation have to be consistent, but when you multiply them, they don't have to be exactly equal, they can differ by this IgG element. So this CAG G1, G2 is a phase, but depend on G1, G2 value. So next, you can, by associativity, you can show that this CAG G1, G2, this IgG element have to satisfy this so-called Tuchel cycle condition. So that this is actually why this SPT in one dimension is classified by H2SG with coefficient U1. Here it's very crucial. There's a G1 group action on this phase variable, on this IgG element. So the main message here is, this formulation is very obvious. So if you apply mirror reflection, no matter you do the bound center mirror or set center mirror, you always find this IgG go to IgG inverse. So that's just tells you that you should think about this as anti-unitary. So it's just like a tangential. Yeah, so that's the main message here. Okay. So I want to just highlight how the symmetry, spatial symmetry, act on this IgG element. So now I can move on to 2D. So 2D, you can also ask yourself this question. So what are the gate transformation that we can have to leave all the single tensors completely invariant? But now we have an infinite number of loops, so you can convince yourself for every plaquette, there is at least a phase IgG like this. So this is one IgG. But it turned out that in order to describe more general, so-called strong SPT phases, you must generalize these phases into matrices. So there are some matrices that leave this tensor invariant. So you have to assume this kind of invariance. Tensor. Yeah, so every local tensor need to be invariant under this transformation rules. So there's some lambda left, lambda right, lambda up, lambda down. So this lambda don't have to be the same, but on the same leg, they have to be inverse of each other. So that's the definition of gate transformation. Okay.
But then, do you want to also enclose the translation solution?
Yeah, you can. So to systematically impose the translational symmetry, these lambdas, this IgG on different plaquettes must be related in some way. Yeah. So that's within the formulation. Yeah.
So what I'm trying to ask is that, I mean, the specific tensor network you're writing down spontaneously presumably break the translational symmetry.
Oh, no. So the point is for every plaquette, you can think about there's an IgG like this. But for different plaquettes, you have a different IgG. So this, as long as this IgG are related by some symmetry, then this translation symmetry, for example, then your tensor network don't break symmetry. I'm not saying you only have this IgG. So you, for every plaquette, there will be some IgG.
But even within one plaquette, is the reason why lambda L should be different from lambda R in those? If you literally require translational symmetry, you can't tell the difference between this leg and the next leg.
It's true, but that's sort of one like a simple way to implement translation symmetry, which turned out to be not that generic. But if you follow that, the point is you can translate the whole thing here. You have this, so IgG is an object. This IgG is an object related to this particular plaquette. So there's another one here. On that one, there's the same lambda L, same lambda L inverse here. But the point is, this lambda L and this lambda R don't have it the same, because they sort of, they're on the two opposite sides of the same IgG. Yeah.
But there are some non-trivial conditions then for the tensor to be left invariant? These are matrices, right? They're not generally going
to certainly. This is strongly constrained your tensor. It's certainly a much larger invariant. It's not the most naive invariance, but to describe SPT, somehow you have to require this. So in order to describe a cohomology SPT, we have to assume for any global matrix invariant gate group can be, say, J. So the J, you can imagine the J that I mentioned earlier, those kind of global IgG. I'll multiply J everywhere, then the tensor completely come back to itself. But we will assume this J have to be decomposable in terms of the product of this lambdas. So every plaquette have a lambda. So the physical reason is this. So if this J cannot be decomposed, then as we mentioned, this tensor net will be topological order. You can construct different degenerate states. But if J can be decomposed into this local plaquette at GG, it turned out that you can show that this J string don't do anything. So namely, you are having a J string condensation, which destroys the topological order. So because we're talking about SPT, we don't have topological order. So that's a sort of physical reason why we require this. So this global matrix IgG decomposition, so you start from global IgG, but you decompose into product of this plaquette object. So this decomposition have an ambiguity. So the reason is it's perfectly fine. Instead of choosing this lambda, I can choose a lambda times this phase. This is a phase plaquette IgG, like a chi star, chi, and so on. So this, if I can multiply this phase on this lambda, but after I do this, it doesn't modify the product of this IgG. So this decomposition have this overall human phase ambiguity. If you fix this ambiguity on one plaquette, you fix it everywhere. So on the whole lattice, you only have one phase ambiguity. And this phase ambiguity turned out to be directly related to this co-cycles, this topological invariance of this tensor equation. So basically, the theory transformation have to satisfy this up to global IgG. Global IgG have to satisfy associativity. But then you decompose the global IgG into plaquette IgG. Then you find after the decomposition, the two sides don't have to be equal. They can be equal up to this this phase ambiguity, which I mentioned. And here the main message is this phase object is like this. And in order to understand, so it turned out this is a Swickel cycle. This is a Swickel cycle appearing in this group cohomology topological phase. But the highlight here is in this picture, it's obvious how this lattice symmetry or spatial symmetry transform this phase. For example, you think about the mirror. No matter you do the mirror here or there, you always send a chi to chi star. So it's like anti-unitary. But if you do rotation or translation, you find the chi always go to chi. So this is why we have this formula with this mirror as anti-unitary. So I can also give you some examples. You can follow similar construction. You can constrain the local Kleber space for SPT, and you can find the much smaller variational parameters to describe what topological phase is. So maybe I should quickly. Okay, so this same construction can be generalized to 3D, but you need to include some volume cell IgG and some plaquette IgG as well. Yeah.
You said earlier that this picture is not complete, right, for the SPT phases.
Yeah, so there are phases beyond the cohomological classifications, for sure. Yeah. So that's what I mean.
In 3 plus 1D, is that the?
Yes, for example, in 3 plus 1D, I think if you consider something like a mirror, you will have more classes.
So you have this, like, say, 15 dimensional space of tensors for that one class you were just showing us, 15 dimensional vector space.
Right.
As you move around that vector space, do you also find that a lot of those tensors, like break symmetries and such?
That's a good question. We don't know. Because you can see everything we do here is a local constraint. So there's no way to know the long-range symmetry breaking. So the claim is if the long-range has no symmetry breaking, then it's a symmetric state described by the cycle. So I think, let me quickly mention this picture. So I was claiming that there's an anti-condensation mechanism. So maybe let me just skip this because I don't want to. Let me just mention the general result. So there's a general result. So start from SET, and what you do is you require the E particle to feature non-trivial symmetry transition. But you require the N particle to have a trivial symmetry transition, but it can carry usual quantum numbers. So that means the symmetry transition pattern will be written like this, where this lambda would be some N particles. So you start from this SET. This is a very simple gauge theory. There's no gapless edge states. And you can have this symmetry factorization only on the E particle. But then you condense the M particle, but you don't want to break the symmetry, so that requires some condition. So the M particle have to carry a one-dimensional symmetry representation, so which is given by this chi, is a U1 variable. And this chi have to be consistent so that you don't break a physical symmetry under the M condensation. But then after you condense M, you will destroy the gauge theory. You will confine the gauge theory. And you have some trivial state with no topological order, but you don't break symmetry. So the claim is, after condensing this M, you get an SPT like this, described by this cycle. This cycle can be constructed from the symmetry transition pattern of the E particle and the quantum number carried by the M particle. So that's the general result. So let me just give you the summary. So summary is this: we are developing this general machinery. So I hope that I convince you it's useful, sort of both practically and also conceptually, and they also provide some physical intuition or physical guideline to realize this SPT phases. So there are a lot of future directions. For example, earlier. In 2D PEPs, I think a few authors introduced this MPO invariance to they use this to characterize SPT in a tensor formulation. So the question is how this formulation are connected with our formulation. And it's also very interesting to consider the fermionic case. I think it seems to be like an interesting topic. And we also want to combine new numerical techniques with this analytical construction to perform more accurate simulations, and also the excitation spectrum. And also I describe some possible realization. So actually I didn't have time to mention this, but maybe the point is this anion condensation mechanism can really be realized if you start from some Z2 spin liquids, for example, can be realized in some quantum dimer model, but you condense some Vison carrying quantum number, then you can get this valence bond solid states, but it could also be SPT phase. So if the condenser, the Vison carries some quantum number. So that's maybe a way to, a route to realize this SPT in bosonic, pure bosonic systems. With this, I will thank you. I'm sorry I'm late for a few minutes.
Okay, thank you very much. You compared your assessment
of the Heisenberg model on the Kagome lattice with the DMRG, like with the snake approach. And you found that your two ground sets were pretty much degenerate in energy, but
that's
you also
right.
had a bit of a higher value compared to the DMRG result.
So DMRG...
I had the impression that the DMRG people had a pretty clear-cut impression which one was the better, that the lower energy state compared to the other. So...
I'm not sure. So I think usually it's a... It's certainly highly non-trivial to read from DMRG the states you have. Yeah. So there are some work along this line. I think Mike Zalato has some interesting way to detect these symmetry transitions using DMRG. But somehow what I heard is for this Kagome problem, it seemed to be non-trivial to read out the state. There's something strange in the numerics. So I would say it's at least from DMRG point of view, it's unclear which states they have, I think.
In the last part of the talk, the reason you insist on condensing bisons and not the E particles is, could you outline the reason?
Cool. So,
would you get the same phases if you kept M?
Yeah. So you know, like a conceptually, certainly you can call E to be M, M to be E. That's perfectly fine. Yeah. But in this realistic models, usually there's a preferred choice to call which E, which to be, which to be M. Yeah, so yeah, maybe that's a short answer. Yeah.
But did you try, or what would happen if you insisted on condensing E?
So you can just go back to this criteria and replace everything about E by M, about everything M by E. It certainly also work. So to distinguish what you mean by E and what you mean by M, so it's better to talk about exactly where the preference come from. So here I choose this preference because in this tensor construction, it's a preferred choice to call which to be E, which to be M. But it's like E want to live on the site and M want to live in the plaquette. If you don't use this formulation, then you have to describe your preference, where the preference comes from.
So you mentioned these two different beyond group homologies.
Right.
So like in 3D,
That's a very good question. So you can see in this series of tensor construction that we have, we actually experience some evolution. So in the first version, we couldn't even capture higher dimension SPT. So now we can capture, in the second version, we can capture bosonic cohomological SPT. But we sharply know where our limitation come from. So it's really come from our assumption in the construction. So the simple answer, short answer is we expect if we relax those constraints. So those are the constraints. So those are the assumption that we put in the tensor construction. You put in the construction, the bosonic homological classification just pop up by itself. But the point is, if we relax this construction, for example, this decomposition may be different, not only by a phase, but maybe by some matrix, then it's maybe possible to describe more general phases. In fact, my student is working on this, at least part-time working on this. So we think if you relax this condition, you can get even general. Have more and more general invariance of your tensor network. Then for different level of invariance, you can describe different level of topological phases.
I guess one thing you can do is just start with a commuting projector model and try to extract the tensor network out of that, just to get an example.
Yeah, that's a good point, yeah. So, yeah, that's an interesting point, yeah. So we should study that. Yeah.
Other questions?